Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/choralchihuahua. On with the app.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Robert here. And before we start, a word from Nicholas, Eamon and me about the current situation with the Choir of St John's Voices at St John's College, Cambridge. If you're not aware, the senior management body of St John's College has taken a decision no longer to fund this mixed voice student choir, which is not to be confused with the chapel choir, which now laudably has boys and girls on the top line. The statement justifies this with a plan for spending the money on other musical things in the college. Much of the outcry is how this negatively impacts adult female students who, as a result, wouldn't have a college choir to sing in anymore. And you can't help think that this follows on from the attempt to close the BBC Singers last year and what feels, from the inside, like a general lack of understanding of the importance of choral singing, both for its own sake and, as composer, singer Roderick Williams said this week, for the mental health of those doing it, at a time when we have a mental health crisis in this country, especially among people of undergraduate age who went through COVID lockdowns while at school. It's absolutely not for the presenters of this podcast to comment on the minutiae of college accounts or to prioritise this case over many other such artistic issues in the UK, from the closure of university music departments based on pretty arguable accounting to badly underfunded music hubs, as discussed in Parliament this week and mentioned by Tim Burnage a couple of episodes back. It's clear that the situation is dire, and this is a single but symptomatic instance of a system travelling in the wrong direction. The Parliament debate mentioned that there are now 20,000 fewer school-age ensembles in the UK than just 7 years ago. So Nicholas, Eamon and I would simply join others in encouraging those in a position of power at St John's to think again. It's a university, after all. We should be encouraging that in such places without criticism, and to consult the choir before going ahead. And to others in positions of financial power, thinking that the arts are an easy cut, to look at how your accounting systems are set up before you define whether music is actually profitable in your institution, and also to think through the financial versus intangible, many intangible other benefits of choral singing, and of course the arts in general. Sermon over, on with the show. So, Eamon, you finally turned up then.
Well, you know, I'd love to say I've missed you, but...
Nice to see you too, Eamon.
No, I've missed you, Sammy.
Oh, God. Look, it's taken six episodes, but we've finally got the three of us in at least a virtual room together to talk not Turkey, but Tenebrae, not the choir, but the Holy Week service of Shadows or Darkness, celebrated on Maundy Thursday, Good Friday and Holy Saturday. We've got some great music, not least a really intriguing piece by Joanna Ward. But Eamon, as you have actually turned up, say the words.
No, I have missed you all, of course. And it's great to be back. Welcome to Choral Chihuahua.
Tenebrae or Shadows.
Tenebrae
So, what exactly is Tenebrae? Conflation of two of the nine Catholic services of the day, Matins and Lourdes. And it features lessons, responses or responsories to those lessons on the Thursday, Friday and Saturday of Holy Week.
Now, it's thought that the text to the responsories comes from the 4th century AD, or CE, as we say these days. Their texts are mostly moments from the last few days of Christ's life, but they also use Old Testament biblical references, notably the ones that seem to presage the suffering of Christ. O Vos Omnes is a good example. See, all you peoples, if there be any sorrow like my sorrow, all you who pass along the way, take heed and see. Or, like a lamb before the shearer, he was silent and opened not his mouth.
Are we going to have a Liverpool Football Club moment?
Almost match of the day, but not quite.
For those who couldn't see it, Sammy's eyes did light up at the possibility of that.
It's like, I remember doing psalms at Windsor opposite Mark de Bellen when the line about the snare of the fowler came out. It was really football eyebrow raise.
For those who don't know who Alan Shearer or someone Fowler are.
Robbie Fowler.
Otherwise known as God.
God, indeed. So a link. Seamless. Shall I carry on? So this next bit of the description of the Tenebrae services by Hugh Keat. The responsories were for the Tenebrae services of the Thursday, Friday and Saturday, and had a uniquely dramatic character. Tenebrae means darkness in Latin, and the services symbolically reenacted the dying of the light as Christ was arrested, tried, tortured, crucified and entombed. The inspiration was perhaps the darkness that covers the land at the moment of Christ's death. I would also possibly say that the inspiration might be the extinction of the light of the world, which is obviously one of the Christ's names.
In Rome, as in most places, and there's been some confusion about this, the night and the dawn offices, the services, that comprised Tenebrae, were done early. They were anticipated on the afternoon or the early evening of the day before, the Wednesday, Thursday and the Friday, which allowed the church's candles to be gradually extinguished as the light went out outside to maximum effect.
6 candles stood on the altar, 15 on a triangular hearse nearby, and all but one of these were extinguished in turn at designated points as the office progressed. Finally, the Christ candle at the apex of the hearse was borne away, leaving the church in complete darkness. In that Stygian gloom, the clergy made some unmusical noise, a shuffling of feet, wrapping of service books on the stalls, to represent a dead, Christless world.
I like the idea that the clergy made an unmusical noise.
I think it seems unlikely, but I'll go with it for now. Well, the Latin word for that, if we're talking about etymology, is strepitus.
Etymology
corner. Which is Latin for great noise.
And what's that got to do with sore throats then?
Well, because you cannot make a great noise with a sore throat.
Streptococcus.
Pardon?
Don't go there. Never mind.
Meanwhile, back at Tenebrae, Psalm 50, or 51, the Miserere, chief of the 7 penitential psalms, had already been chanted each day at Lourdes, but the rubrics ordered that each cleric should now repeat it, muttering it to themselves. Finally, the Christ candle was carried back, and all withdrew in silence.
So we're going to hear our first track now. And Robert, this is from Fagiolini's new recording of the Victoria Tenebrae responsories, Sepulto Domino. The text being, having buried the Lord, they sealed the tomb, rolling a rock before the tomb entrance, placing soldiers to guard it. The chief priests came to Pilate, petitioning him.
Volvente labile, volvente.
That was Sepulto Domino from Victoria's Tenebrae Responsories, the final of the responsories for Holy Saturday. Singers there were Martha McLaurin, Matt Long, Greg Skidmore, and Freddie Long, no relation, directed by of this parish, Robert Hollingworth. Robert, that's a new disc out. I've got lots of questions actually about that. It's like we said, it's the final of the responsories. It has a real sense of that rolling over of the stone across the tomb and a kind of extinguishing of the light and like we said earlier, withdrawing into silence. Tell us what inspired you to go to these pieces to record.
There's two things. I have lived with them for a long, long time. I mean, obviously one doesn't record most music, but those have been on my radar. And, you know, as you both know, Fagellini's mostly, until a few years ago, done secular music. But I just think they're extraordinary. You know, we're going to hear a bit of Gesualdo in a minute. And Gesualdo is over the top and extraordinary and absolutely where one sphere of writing at the end of 16th century was going. But you've got Victoria just kind of like a French chef distilling everything to just four voices. And the, you know, the tagline we've used for the recording is, how can you do so much with so little? Because at times it's three voices or even two. And it's so perfect. It allows the listener, I suppose, like in a good film, the listener to put their own interpretation on it. But I also think with those particular singers, their tuning is really excellent, which is something we've worked at a lot. But they all have, I think, a complete understanding. They're completely comfortable in that style, but they also have an edge to their voice when they need it. So I find that it's a very live sound, even though the emotional frame of the whole thing is deliberately restrained.
Yeah, we said earlier about it being a dramatic service, that the drama of this music is not kind of outward facing, really, is it? I remember you and I did this in a concert last Easter, and I remember feeling this, because I'd never really sung them. I've actually sung them in liturgical context quite a bit, but I'd never sung them as a concert piece. And there's a sense of kind of, I felt, of going on this journey of reflection and sorrow, really, with individual singers, which I think is really effective on the disc, is that you sort of learn their voices. And because the textures are so sparse and so economical, you get a real sense of a growing familiarity with each person's kind of psychological approach to their text, which I think is really rewarding.
I think one of the things that struck me about this is that exactly that, Sammy, I likewise have sung these pieces liturgically quite a lot. This performance feels much more like a private devotion. And I think, as you say, hearing the individual personalities coming through, that's quite a new thing for me, hearing these pieces, that you could almost imagine them being sung round the table, in much in the way that we've talked about, you know, Byrd's music or his masses being sung, you know, for that purpose. This is how it felt to me listening to this recording.
Yeah, we've spoken about this before, haven't we, on the podcast, that the idea of public performance for this music is probably not something that Victoria would have recognised. And this setting particularly, it's very private. It's almost like even if the singers were in the church in front of the congregation somehow, you would still not wish to kind of deliver this music externally somehow. It's a drawing into the world rather than the presenting of something, right?
And even in sort of post Council of Trent Rome, which was, you know, the time after which they tried to reform the Catholic Church after the growth of Protestantism in the first half of the 16th century, you've still got quite a sort of private view. You know, the idea that the priest has his back to the congregation while he's celebrating, and there's no sense that this, you know, even, you know, great multi choir stuff in Venice, there's no suggestion that is being written for the hoi polloi to listen to down in the main body of the church. It's something for the people in the expensive seats up at the front. So it is a private thing, but it was from a collection for all the music for Holy Week.
Is it late Victoria, or when was it written? Do you know?
1585 it's published. So towards the end of his time in Rome. But he was born 1548, so he's only 37.
And he then goes back to Spain, doesn't he? where he writes things like the Requiem, because it feels to me like it's so, like you said about this distillation, all these really exposed, almost nerve endings on each line. It feels to me like the late style. It feels like late Schubert or something, where everything is, you couldn't change a single note.
Yeah, or late Beethoven, you know, where it or Josquin, where actually we never know what's early and what's late Josquin, but there's very, very static and non-polyphonic textures. And the glorious thing about it is that the polyphony, and we're back to Dr. Katie Banks' point about three-part polyphony. When it's three-part, and it's very rarely proper four-part polyphony in this, you can hear everything. You can follow the argument, so you can follow the text. So the other voices saying the text at the same time seems like a reinforcement of the text and not a sort of obfuscation of it.
So each of these responsories, if I'm not mistaken, is structured so we hear the principal idea, then a secondary idea with smaller forces, hear the principal idea again, a third idea, and then a repetition again. So in sort of baked into this stuff is the idea of repetition and reflection and I think possibly transformation in terms of the same music returns and means different things. How did you approach that on record?
It is tricky because we're trying not to do the same thing every time. And in fact, there's extra repetitions in the 3rd, 6th, 9th, 12th, 15th and 18th piece where you have to go right back to the beginning. And I think you have to be very Lutheran about it, actually. You have to be very rhetorical about it. And if you say something a second or a third time, there really has to be a reason. And with those four singers that, you know, are used to standing up and delivering solo work as well, they can really be responsible for that. But we did find that there was a sort of natural way to do it, which is the first time, you know, the music would lead you, and the second time it would want to be more dramatic. And if there was a third time, which there is in those six pieces, it would need to be more reflective.
And like all this music that's kind of so remote in time, I suppose we have to be careful that we're not imposing 21st, 20th, 19th century ideas onto it when we deliver it.
Yeah, I think that's not... Well, I can see, you know, if you're a choir director, you have that need to express the piece. But actually, when singers are that good and they're that experienced, you know, they're playing a sort of game with each other. And they fizz off each other. You know, Claire Wilkinson talks about this, doesn't she? And I think you have to stay within the emotional frame of the piece. You know, suddenly, and this is the conversation about the famous recording with Westminster Cathedral that we talked about on this podcast quite a bit, in that it's highly interpreted, which really fitted the, you know, the people's listening habits at the time and still does now. People have been tweeting, oh, you'll never beat the Westminster Cathedral recording. But this relates to pitch as well, in that we've recorded this down nearly a fifth from the pitch that Victoria printed it at, because the clefs he used implied transposition down into something, frankly, that just fits the normal Renaissance vocal ranges of the time, which means that everyone is in a sensible vocal range and you're not having to use extremes. So I feel it's closer to a sort of spoken delivery. But the interesting one for me is Matt Long, you know, who has a rich tenor voice, but he seemed to be happy withdrawing into a sort of really balanced, smaller sound for this alto part. But you still get more of the alto part than you would if it was up a fourth and you had sort of countertenors on it. So I like the effect of the internal balance, but the ability of the characters to almost speak through this at this pitch.
You talked about how you've lived with these pieces for a long time, Robert. And likewise, one of the first CDs I ever bought was David Hill's recording of these pieces with Westminster Cathedral Choir. So the one after the George Malcolm one. And, you know, I listened to that ad infinitum and love it dearly. Hearing your recording in this lower pitch, despite knowing these pieces quite well, they're almost unrecognisable at times. It makes such a difference to how one experiences the piece. But what I would say is that as soon as I started listening to it, it felt absolutely right to be hearing it in this pitch with this combination of voices.
Isn't there a thing about early music that it has somehow to be different, and there must be, you know, specialisms involved, and it should sound weird and unusual. And we tend to buy into that, and reviewers buy into that, if I may, sometimes. And, you know, the extraordinary and wonderful recordings of the Clerks of Oxenford with everything at terribly high pitch, which I think is, you know, now pretty much discredited, not expressively or musically, but as far as actual historically informed performance is concerned. People do like that kind of thing. And when you sort of take the pressure out of it and just allow the voices to do their expressive job. And it's the same with, you know, the final movement of the Monteverdi Vespers or the male voice choruses in Orfeo. They should be transposed down. It was a normal thing. The question people always ask, well, why didn't he just write them at the pitch he wanted? And the answer is, had he printed it a fifth lower at that mode, he would have had to have had two flats in the key signature, and that you just didn't do at the time.
Just a point on that. Janet Baker says this brilliant, sorry, Dame Janet Baker says this brilliant thing about a performer's job, which is to, if you think of the music as a plate of glass, performer's job is just to continually polish the glass so that you're always presenting the music in its purest and most distilled form. And I think that's what you're talking about, that sense of just trying to actually show the music to its best advantage, its greatest clarity, and find the way of expressing what's in the music most clearly. That's not always what happens, is it?
No, and I think we have to be careful of creating two different schools here. The school that says, but that's not expressive, I'm going to do it my way. I think that's a sort of false dichotomy, in that I want to start with what Victoria, or as close to what I understand as what Victoria had in his mind, and then to be expressive with it. In this case, you don't have to go very far because the music is so clear. But this thing about, you know, I want to hang from a chandelier in gold lame and sing this up a fifth, that's great. You know, knock yourself out, but don't
it's
pretend
not really,
that's
it's.
But don't pretend that's what
you not me, obviously.
I want to know how you managed to get so much detail and yet have so much space around the sound as well.
Okay, well, congratulations to Adrian Hunter. We don't sing the praises of producers and engineers enough. Chapeau. But slightly serendipitous. So we went down to Milton Abbey in Dorset, and Adrian rang me on the morning, said, look, I'm a bit worried because at the end of the church that we're meant to be, there's a very loud kitchen fan coming off the school and they can't turn it down or off. It has to be on while they're working. And we got there and it's true, and you could hear it on the sound. So we had to shift down to the other end of the chapel, which wasn't at all where we were meant to be. And it just produced an even better sound, punctuated by the karate course going on outside, which we had been assured wouldn't be anywhere near us, but unfortunately it was. But I don't think there are too many sounds through this. If listeners can spot one, they can send it in and I'll send them a free copy. Look, let's go on. Let's go on to Gesualdo, and allowing the music to speak for itself, go straight to a recording by Tenebrae 1 to a part, with this text, Tristis, as sorrowful is my soul unto death. Stay here and watch with me. Now you shall see the mob that will surround me. You will take flight, and I shall go to be sacrificed for you.
Oh!
Tristis est anima mea by Gesualdo. That was Tenebrae, conducted by Nigel Short, with the singers Grace Davidson, Julia Doyle, Jeremy Budd, David De Winter, Gabriel Crouch, and Jimmy Holiday.
That's a pretty classy team, isn't it?
It's a top lineup.
It's top lineup. And I had a pleasurable morning listening to different versions of this. And, you know, there's a really good one by the King Singers. Gesualdo Six have done it. You know, lots of groups have done this. Hilliard Ensemble in the old days. We're back to the voice types again, in that you have two of what we just heard in the Victorias, the Martha type, then a high tenor, and then there's a couple of baritones and a bass, six voices here. And if you look at that on the first page, it looks like tears falling down a page. Ya-da-dum-da-da-dum-da. Down they all flow. And it's music that has a very strong visual look, and it is brilliantly put together. By the composer, you know, all the voice leading, all the stuff that composers get excited about. But it's everything that Victoria isn't, and the Victoria is everything that that isn't, I think.
There's the moments of sort of high drama, the vos fugam capietis at the end, which I listened to this after I'd been listening to your recording of the Victoria, and exactly that, there could not be more different in that sense, this sudden explosion of a sort of outpouring of overt emotion, which it seems almost too much when you've just been listening to the Victoria.
I was going to say, we've said this about Gesualdo in relation to Monteverdi before, that I love it, but with him you get often, or I often get a sense that it's kind of music that says, look at me, this is clever, isn't it? What a good effect. Whereas actually, in this instance with the Victoria, the structure of the music, the construction of it, seems much truer to the text and to the liturgical purpose, no?
Yes. I mean, Gesualdo is working in a milieu of trying to show off to other composers and being the most modern. And these are, he came to Ferrara, he was desperate to get to Ferrara and to be with other musicians there that were at the cutting edge of expressive performance. And it really is the thing. I mean, I do think they're brilliant pieces. But I think that they almost fit more in the magical world than they do with the sacred world. And they are a sort of precipice. You get expressively to a sort of precipice. I mean, this isn't his most chromatic stuff. There are chromatic pieces by his that are not an awful long way from Richard Strauss. And you can see that music at this stage is sort of, well, where do we go next? Are we going to go what Schoenberg called pantonal, so all the keys at once, which the rest of us called atonal? And music pulls back from that. And although you get some, you know, weird Purcell pieces that get very, very chromatic and dissonant at times, you can't actually go any further than this. And, you know, I was talking to students yesterday about this and, you know, why still go back to Monteverdi? Because it's so expressive within the confines of music that still seems to make sense. I noticed Owen Park writes about this in his recording of the pieces, talks about the Gesualdo murder of his wife. And the view is always that, oh, Gesualdo murdered his wife and then spent the rest of his life writing music to
to atone for this. And there's really no suggestion that this is the case. Dr. Ruth McAllister did a lot of work on this. She's a forensic psychiatrist. And we had a Fagellini project called Betrayal, didn't we? And the idea was not that he felt guilt, but that, in fact, the very opposite, that he felt betrayed by everyone around this. So that's why he might go for these texts and have a particular take on them. I mean, they are magnificent pieces. And this is a pretty, you know, this is a really good recording, I think. But it is interesting listening to other recordings, because there were things about the Gesualdo 6 recording. I mean, the tuning is sensationally good. But there were things about the King Singers recording as well, which I think is from early 2000s, which is also fantastic. We're going to go Baroque, aren't we? It's time for our Baroque slot.
What have we got, Robert?
I think, you know, in the same way that had we done the Lent programme and not included the Talis Lamentations, if we're doing Tenebrae and don't do part of the François Couperin ones, that there will be letters. Not, in fact, the responsories, but one of the lessons. And again, you two, have you got a favourite recording of this piece? We're not going to play it, but have you got...
Well, but the first one that I had was Emma Kirkby and Judith Nelson with Chris Hogwood playing from years ago, which I absolutely love. I've got to say, the one you've chosen, though, became a favourite of mine in later years.
It's pretty top, isn't it? Similarly, I first heard a different one. I first heard the Jordi Savalls with Montserrat. I can't remember who the second.
That's lovely as well.
It is. Yes. And Montserrat Figuera is so distinctive and... very expressive in a very personal way, but then this one quickly became my favorite. It's very special, isn't it?
Yeah, I was listening to it with my French Baroque wife the other day, and it's because I went back to it. We listened to this one first, and then listened to a whole load of other ones, and we both felt this is too high. This is only down a semitone, whereas French pitch at the time is thought to have been a further semitone than that. And most of the other recordings these days, yeah, David Bates has done one with La Nuova Musica, which is great. Anna Dennis is on one for Jonathan Cohen, I think.
Aye, okay.
And it is easier at that lower pitch, but this is Sophie Daneman with Patricia Petitbon, and the French is just brilliant. And these are people who've just done an awful lot of French Baroque, and the ornaments are exquisite and utterly sung in. And sometimes with English singers, you get that, I'm going to do a French ornament now. Well, these are people who've sat there and listened and worked with Christie and all the others, and it's just exquisite.
it's such a particular repertoire with a very particular style. And exactly as you said, Robert, you can just hear the years of close proximity to this music and deep immersion in its beguiling singing and the expressive license that they take with the ornamentation, which is not too much and always just on the right side of the line. Brilliant.
That was François Couperin's Troisième Leçon de Ténèbres with a 1997 recording with Patricia Petitbon and Sophie Daneman and Les Arts Florissants, directed by William Christie.
My director of music, Edward Higginbottom at New College, had written the article on François Couperin in the great music encyclopedia Grove. And he was marking an essay by Julian McNamara, the then organ scholar. And Julian showed it to me later, and it just had, he'd obviously heavily lifted parts of it from that article without thinking twice. And there was just a big line through it. At the bottom it said, "I wrote this."
Yes, I've heard that story many times. But interestingly, when I was also studying with Edward and became interested in this music of the French Baroque and was started to perform your works by Charpentier and Couperin, and I went to him and said, "Look, you know, if I'm going to do this music, I need to learn how to ornament it properly." And he said, "Well, I could lend you a book, but honestly, the best thing you can do is go and listen to Bill Christie's recordings." And that was coming from a man who, you know, as you say, wrote the article on Couperin. And that experience just shines through in this music, in this performance, doesn't it? And that's exactly what I did.
There's also something about the French vowels. I notice a lot of the English singers now in new recordings trying to do the French Latin. Interestingly, they don't sing attendite, they sing attendite. I'm no expert on this, but there is that, you know, the nasal vowel, the un bon vin blanc, that slight tang that they have to that is just, it's just glorious.
Yeah, and I'm having sung with Sophia over the years a few times, she just pours herself into things so expressively, and that one of the things that makes her such a good recording artist particularly is that it's so generous and committed. You don't get the feeling she's worried about too much about technical details. It's much more about giving herself fully to the music. So.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Coral Chihuahua, and you may have just been subjected to a number of irritating ads. We encourage you to banish the ads by listening instead on patreon.com. And if you go to patreon.com and look up Coral Chihuahua, you can, for as little as £3 a month, you can banish the ads, which is, you know, probably good for your health in all sorts of ways. And it also helps us make the program and not lose money on it. And as Sammy said last time, any gift is welcomed, however generous or mean, I think you said. Yeah, so lovely, lovely Charpentier. And of course...
And when I say Charpentier, I of course mean François Couperin.
The piece is much... there's got a lot of solos in it as well as these duets, but what we've really heard there is the initial letter, as in with the Talis Lamentations, where you get Aleph and Daleth and Gimel, the initial letter, like a sort of ornamented initial. And that's what you get with the two sopranos there, with suspension after suspension. I should say it's an absolute nightmare to breathe that piece in the initials. And again, that's another thing that Petitbon and Damon make a really good go at. One thing about this piece is you might imagine a sort of big French church somewhere with these things being sung in the night. Well, actually, this one seems to have been written for the Abbey of, I've forgotten where it was, but there are criticisms at the time that actually people are just turning up to these things for the music, rather like in Venice listening to the choirs at the Pietà, and the performers, this is a contemporary report, the performers appearing from behind the curtain, waving at their friends in the audience.
That would never happen nowadays, would it?
No, absolutely not. Well, yeah, would it a school pantomime, you know, or a nativity play or so? There'd be lots of that.
Okay, look, let's have a next bit of music now. This is Francis Poulenc's Ténébré Facte Sunt. This is from, not from a Ténébré set, but from Quatre Montées pour le Temps de Pénitence, I think they're called, which is slightly brings us back to what we talked about in our last episode about Lent. So four motets for a time of penitence. And I love these Poulenc motets. We used to do one, Tristis Est Anima Mea, which I think is part of the same set, in the Good Friday night service in Liverpool Met when I was a chorister. I remember being completely entranced by the sound world and the kind of strangeness, really, of the music then.
It is strange. Is it strange to sing? It's incredibly angular. And with this one, perhaps there's sort of, you know, the angularity of the cross, the pain. These aren't really Lenten motets, although they are, the English translation is Lenten motets. But it's, as you just said, it's four motets for a time of penitence. And they were written just before the outbreak of the Second World War. Of course, they didn't know the Second World War, but it was pretty clear something was happening. And three of the texts are, in fact, from the Ténébré service. But I think we should be looking as a sort of a Lenten, a penitential time, which Victoria was talking about last week, in the shadow of something pretty devastating about to happen. And I know that's history the wrong way round, but I don't think they are specifically Lenten pieces.
And credit, I've just remembered, to the Reverend Peter McGeary, who first came up with that thought.
I think that's one of my, regular listeners will know that I wang on about Easter any possible opportunity, but it's one of my favorite things about the music for this time of year is the way that it's, obviously we talk a lot about music for the sort of Christian church, because that's where most of the stuff we're brought up with resides. But I love the way that parts of the Easter story and the Passion story are completely transferable to just normal and everyday and non-religious human life. And I really love what Poulenc does with that. He draws a religious theme but makes it universal, which I think is an incredibly valuable quality that music can bring to stuff.
Ténébré facte sunt. The day grew dark as the Jews nailed Jesus to the cross. And at about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" And he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. Jesus said in a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit."
incredibly raw, naked setting of those words, Deus Meus. It reminded me, Sammy, of the Gabrieli setting in Ecclesiastes of Deus Meus, a very dramatic harmonic shift. And that's a new recording by Trinity Cambridge. They've recorded the pieces before Stephen Layton, as he does his sort of farewell tour with them after being at Trinity Cambridge for so long. And it's pretty fantastic singing. I noticed that the Durfle Requiem that they do on the same disc was actually recorded in Paris in the Church of Saint-Eustache, the patron saint of facial hair, with amazing organ there. I was talking about that on Record Review the other day. So I think that's a really interesting new recording there. But I don't think they're Lenten motets. Well, they do work as Lenten. I suppose that's why we're talking about them today. But I think the shadow of the war is a thing to bear in mind.
I was just struck on listening to it. The first thing I thought when I heard it was, it's incredible the flexibility that young voices, working with young voices, gives you. And the way they managed to switch so quickly from this incredibly spare, sort of transparent sound at the beginning, and then immediately onto this fuller sound. It's really, really impressive. The great clarity, the tuning is very, very impressive as well. Even when they sing Voce Magna, the crescendo there, it's got a real searing quality to it. It's very, very impressive performance.
I think a word actually on that, because Stephen or Sid has just left Trinity after, I think, close on 20 years. Is that right? And they're going to be big shoes to fill. He's done an amazing job there. They've done some really wonderful things, which aren't easy to achieve, are they, in a collegiate setting? I think Trinity particularly capable of lending considerable support. But I think some of the discs that have come out of there in his time there have been really, really tremendous. And as you say, Eamon, they reflect like a seriousness of approach and a technical facility that's really remarkable, I think, in a choir of young voices.
The reason I chose that particular track, having listened to a lot of other really good recordings, including 16 and plenty of others, is that passage where you get the lower voices on quite an open vowel, which risks masking detail, and the upper voices have bam, ba ba bam, ba ba bam, ba ba ba. That's the only recording in which you can really hear that, and that's characteristic of Stephen's ear for detail. I've never been in a recording session with him, but I've talked with lots of people who have, and you know, it can get almost irritating at times, and that he's so focused on the final result. But you know, we get the benefit of that afterwards.
Yeah, he has an amazing, almost kind of supernatural instinct and feeling for sound and how to extract the sound that he has in his head from a group of singers. I think it's quite something.
I don't know how many of... I was going to link into the final piece now, but anyone else want to say anything about Tenebrae? Sammy, do you want to get back to... Eamon's got something.
So 23 years ago, I was a member of the choir of the Brompton Oratory. That's the London Oratory, the big Catholic church, which is immediately to the left of the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. I took part in my first full round of Easter services there. And at the oratory, we do all the Tenebrae services as you would expect. And the Easter liturgy is done with such incredible love and devotion. But I could not believe that, like, the vocal shock of how much music there was to sing in a very short, a condensed space of time. It really took my breath away. It took my voice away as well by the end of the few days. But I would just say to people that if you're interested in hearing this music live in its liturgical context with Holy Week coming up, go and hear the wonderful choir at the Brompton Oratory, directed by Patrick Russell. The service times are all online, and it's very special and really worth hearing this music in the context for which it was potentially written.
I'd agree with that, Eamon. That's really well said. And I used to do it when I sang at Westminster Cathedral for a while, and we didn't actually do Tenebrae there, but a few of us used to do Maundy Thursday service at the Drome, as it's called, and then hop up the road to Corpus Christi on Maiden Lane, which is right in the midst of bustling Covent Garden. And we used to sing the Tenebrae services there with a guy called Charles Finch. And as you said, Eamon, it's such a theatrical, feels like not quite the right word, but it's a very, very, in an incredibly restrained way, a spectacular sort of experience to feel and hear this music in person, in its setting, with this gradual and very poignant, I think, extinguishing of lights. Yeah, recommend that. I don't know if they still do it at Corpus Christi there, but it seems music particularly designed for its liturgy.
Now, I had to say I didn't know any music for Tenebrae that wasn't by white male composers. So I put a bit of a call out on Facebook and had some really interesting responses. Not all of the ones suggested had actually been recorded. And there were actually two that caught my eye on the Gesualdo 6 disc Tenebrae that came out in 2022, so 2 years ago. One was an intriguing setting by Judith Bingham, which has a Wilfred Owen poem overlaid over the Latin. But the one we're going to go is by Joanna Ward. Now, the thing that gets me about this is the texture. You've got six voices, you've got a sort of Rolls-Royce ensemble like Gesualdo 6, and she barely uses it, which I think is incredibly brave and really interesting. She's just got this top two voice duet, and she's happy to have this sparseness and then sort of muttering. Now, there's not very much in the sleeve note that tells me about her thought process. I've been to a quite interesting website. She's an interesting thinker and writer. It's worth, especially for composers, actually, you might find interesting thoughts there written by Joanna. But I just thought that was, again, an intriguing way of approaching the text.
By way of contrast with the Victoria and the Gesualdo, where the text is very much allowed to flow, the way she takes almost like individual syllables here and sort of focuses on them. You've got these bits, these moments of Senza Misura writing as well, which incidentally, Gesualdo 6 managed to make it sound like it's a much bigger group. That's not an easy thing to achieve with a small number of voices.
Senza Misura being no fixed time.
Yeah, no fixed time, and people just reciting texts at their own speed.
It's also an interesting, I mean, I'm not a composer, so I'd have to defer on this, but I feel like this text is so famous for the Bruckner setting. So it's one of one of the first things anyone in any choir sings, particularly obviously sort of British church choir. And it's a brilliant approach to kind of deconstructing that problem, because it's so wildly different and so has its own distinct voice that I never felt like I missed the version I was so familiar with.
Christus factus est pro nobis obediens usque ad mortem. Christ became for us obedient unto death. Joanna Ward's setting of Christus Factus Est, performed by Gesualdo Six, countertenors Guy James and Andrew Leslie Cooper, tenors Joseph Wicks and Josh Cooter, and baritones Michael Craddock and Samuel Mitchell, directed by Owen Park. And some very impressive humming from Guy and Andrew there. That's not easy to do.
When I hear Guy sing, I just think, because I've seen Guy sing live and he has fantastic breath control. As well, and he just seems to be able to sit up there, as does Joe Wicks, of course, that we've mentioned many times, right at the top of the tenor.
I was in Cambridge last week and I noticed they did their 10th birthday concert in Trinity Chapel, which was, I wasn't able to make, but was a lovely thing.
Guys, lovely to see you again, even if just down the line. But I know it's a crazy, we had great difficulty in finding a space that we could all meet. Eamon, you've had a crazy springtime. What's coming up? What are you doing at the moment?
Well, just actually currently getting ready for a Matthew Passion with my chamber choir, the Thomas Tallis Society. The first time I'm going to be conducting that, so super excited about that. But actually, we were talking about the Druffley Requiem, which is on the same recording with Trinity Choir's performance of those Poulenc motets, and very much looking forward to performing the Druffley at Snape Malting with the 16 on Holy Saturday. So, yeah, I haven't done the Druffley for years now, so really looking forward to revisiting that.
What do they use for an organ then at Snape Malting's?
Oh, they've got a little hand-pumped little chamber organ, I'd imagine. No, I've no idea. I would imagine they've probably got, an electric, like a...
Hauptwerk.
What do they call it? Hauptwerk, exactly, yes. Something along those lines. So for it could be a sampling of Saint-Eustache, for all we know.
Pumped. We've had an incident here. I used a perfectly reasonable phrase to describe how organs got their sound, and it's been withdrawn from circulation. The referee is on the pitch. I'm being sent
complete
off.
Contraire. Sorry, that's a straight red for me.
Yes, that is a straight red.
Anyway, Sammy, are you Matthewing or Johnning at the moment?
Yeah, well, a bit of both. I've just actually been in Cambridge doing a really interesting project. So co-directing two John Passions with Maggie Faultless, but also incorporating some work about the physical and emotional effects of the music. Of course, we think about Bach as such a great mind, but Professor Bettina Favi, who's brilliant on actual physical effects of dissonance and consonants and dancing and that kind of stuff that early modern listeners would have recognised and understood. So we did a performance of the St. John in the round, really, with lots of movement amongst the performers, including, you know, chorales where the singers would sing to an instrumentalist or sing to a member of the audience, which was a really lovely thing. It's a big thing to ask students to do that, to learn that piece and commit to it so fully. But I was really pleased, and they did a great job. And it was incredible feedback, actually, from the audience. So that's been lovely.
I know she's just been on Radio 3, and I've been meaning to meet up with her. She sounds like someone we should talk to, really, really interesting.
She's just brilliant. You know, she's the sort of best academic. She's able to, she understands things so well that she's able to explain the most sophisticated, you know, ideas in language that even I understand.
Well, not to bang Cambridge's drum, but I'm going to be there as well on April the 13th doing a concert of two Morales masses, Eamon and I at the moment. conducting a 10-CD series of the complete recording of Morales's masses. And as we get ready for the next one, it's L'Homme, two L'Homme masses. One in the Ionian mode, that's normal C major scale, and one in the Phrygian mode. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's very odd to hear the L'Homme, L'Homme, L'Homme tune going through the whole mass like that. That's on April the 13th. 13th, look up De Profundis, Cambridge, if you're interested.
Lovely. Do you know why, you know, jazz musicians use a lot of modal music? Do you know why modal music is so cool? Because they left the Phrygian Dorian open.
Stupid boy. That's the end of our little series of six. We normally take 2 weeks between. We'll take 3 weeks now, let Easter happen. And we'll be back, hopefully, with an Eamon episode on April the 15th. I'm going to say that now. Eamon's doing the episode on April the 15th. Now you're going to have to go and record it. Lovely to see you, chaps. Thanks for listening, folks. Remember to listen to us on Patreon. Sign up now. See you next time.
Bye for now.
Cheerio.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Just before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.